Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, May 3rd, 2018. Talking to you live from warm, even sultry New York City. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. The 73-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective, we invite you to join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
Saurabh Amari is off today. And I didn't know we were going to talk about it on this podcast at 6 o'clock yesterday evening. And then at around 10 o'clock yesterday evening, it was pretty clear what we were going to be talking about. Rudy Giuliani, the president's new consigliere, went on Sean Hannity's show, and despite the best efforts of the Fox News Channel to make absolutely no news when it comes to the Trump administration, he made so much news, I don't even know how to unpack it. But there was news about why a new theory of the case about why the president fired James Comey from Rudy Giuliani that completely flips the president's own claims in the week of the firing on their head. And then a whole lot of talk about Stormy Daniels, the porn star payoff, and Michael Cohen, the president's fixer lawyer, and what was going on there. So where do we begin?
Say what was said.
Okay.
Why don't we start there?
Okay. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, the big revelations, I think, from that interview were, and I have some thoughts about how this was revealed, but let's just go with substance first. First, he's talked about how Donald Trump fired James Comey explicitly because he would not tell him and the world that the investigation into the Trump campaign that the FBI was conducting at the time was not targeting him. Donald Trump said as much essentially to Lester Holt on NBC News shortly after that he let James Comey go, that this was all about the Russia probe and that I was innocent and I wanted to hear that I was innocent and the public needs to hear that I was innocent. But then the campaign and the White House began walking that back. And has been walking that back and held to that line until precisely 9-something last night. So this is news. We shouldn't pretend that it's not news. Second, and what's blotting out the sun this morning, is Rudy Giuliani saying very explicitly that there was a payoff to Stormy Daniels because they didn't want the information that she was about to reveal to the public to come out on October 15th, 2016, in the middle of a debate with Hillary Clinton. They wanted Cohen to make this go away, and so there was a payment to Stormy Daniels to be quiet, and Donald Trump was aware of that payment. He knew everything that happened with regards to that payment, contradicting statements that the president had made as recently as 19 days ago, very explicitly. No, I'm not aware of this payment. You have to ask Michael Cohen. Not aware of any shell companies that he created to funnel this money. A funnel, by the way, was a word that Rudy Giuliani used to funnel this money to
a law firm.
A law firm to funnel this money to, although it was actually an LLC that Mr. Cohen created explicitly for the purposes of paying off Ms. Daniels. So, or Clifford, whatever her name is. So, yeah, there was a lot of news made last
right.
night, and the argument today is essentially over strategy, whether or not that was intentional. What I saw in body language is not evident in the transcripts. What I saw when he was talking about this is new information for you, Sean, that this payment was not a campaign finance violation because it came one step removed out of Donald Trump's personal pocket.
Right. Okay, so we should also go
and
back.
That, to me, right. struck me when he was saying that as improvisatory. He didn't seem like he was saying something that had been rehearsed to
okay.
me.
Okay, I'm not sure I agree, but let's unpack the it's not a campaign finance violation line from Rudy about why if Michael Cohen paid $130,000, you can only give $4,600, I think, unless there are $7,200. I can't remember. You can only give, can only provide a contribute a hard money contribution of $4,600 to a campaign, and you, if you provide an in kind contribution of $130,000, you're violating campaign finance law. That's the idea, okay? Or, and the campaign is guilty because it accepts the donation, and the person is guilty who gives it. However, it should be said that
gifts and loans.
Gifts and loans. It should be said the campaign finance law is not felonious. This is campaign finance law as its own sort of area of law. The only time that anybody has been prosecuted for campaign finance law violations as a potential felony was John Edwards, also relating to payoffs of a to Edwards' mistress. And that case ended with a jury acquitting Edwards on the grounds that this did not seem to be a violation of nobody was hurt or something like that. Okay, so campaign finance law is a thing that you can violate and then you break the law. But you know, the Obama campaign was fined $375,000 for accepting $2 million in foreign donations. And it does not seem to rise to the level of, you know, some kind of thing where someone will have to step down from office because people violate campaign finance law all the time. Okay. Here's the thing that Giuliani was saying. He was saying this was not a violation of campaign finance law because Cohen and Trump had a relationship in which Trump gave Cohen money and Cohen did things with that money to protect Trump. Trump this morning tweets that people of wealth often have people who do this sort of thing and negotiate non-disclosure agreements with people, and this is something that happens. And I think Rudy said last night that Trump, that Cohen made this go away and that was his job, what he was saying was this is what Cohen did. He did it for Trump running as president, he did it for Trump in other ways. There were other such pay, and you know, this is how things are done. Okay, so one way of looking at this is that you're saying Rudy improvised. I think something else might be going on, but either he was improvising or if he wasn't improvising, this was like Rudy opening a curtain, the way that Trump opened a curtain in 2015, 2016, when asked, why did you give money to the Clintons? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? And he would say, basically, the meta message was, let's not be naive. Don't be children. I don't know what planet you're living on, but in the world that I live in, people pay for access. People give donations because they need things from politicians. I do it. Everybody does it. Don't be a baby or a child and pretend that you either you don't know this, so you're hopelessly naive, but don't pretend that you don't know that this is how the world works. So effectively, Rudy said last night, don't be naive. This is how the world works. This woman comes to extort from Trump, and they make a calculation about what would be best. Would it be best to, like, tell her to go away and screw off? Or would it be better to just pay her for her silence, because that's the easiest way to go? And that's what we did, and that's what happens. And everybody does it, and don't you think they don't? And, you know, at the least what you're going to get from me, maybe I'm not letting you live in airy fairy land where you think that everything is above board and wonderful, but at least I'm giving you the truth. I'm telling you the way things really are. This is the world as it is.
That would be great if that truth maker line was what they stuck to initially. Instead, we've had dissimulation for the last several months and feigned offense and shock at the very notion that there would be a payoff to this porn star actress in order to shield the president from an accusation 11 days before the election.
Right. Well, but you know, Trump was operating under competing threats. One was the being exposed as having an affair, and the other was this campaign finance issue. So they... He figures, okay, you know, at this point, there's not a single person in the world who doesn't think that he had an affair, there's still some damage control to be done regarding a campaign finance violation.
I mean, part of this is, there are so many strands to the Trump misbehavior story that even separating out the strands in which Cohen is involved. So first there's the moral strand, right? The moral strand is Donald Trump slept with a porn star while his wife was pregnant with his, you know, about to give birth to his child in 2006. It happened once, according to her. And when it was going to come out, he paid for her silence because, and yet all of Trump's hardcore evangelical supporters and the like are doing whatever it is that they're doing. They accept it. They're not, you know, and how can this be? They're supposed to be, you know, moral and believe that our leaders should behave morally and all of that. So there's the moral strand. Okay. Then there's the legal strand. So the legal strand really seems to be two competing legal things, one of which is she signed a non-disclosure agreement. It's binding. She got paid $130,000. Now she wants to get out of it. Effectively, she is out of it because she's been talking, right? So is somehow the fact that she made this deal of her own free will, somehow she's just simply able to walk out of it? That would be the Trump side in its darkest and most cynical, right? Which is like, she's breaking a binding contract. Like she should be sued the hell out of for that. And that's not, and then the other legal strand is this campaign finance question. Was the payment that was made to her illicit because it somehow violated campaign finance law?
Here's why I think they actually stepped in it last night, and this wasn't part of a strategy. A, the body language, like I said, this was just sort of the hands were in the air, and he was like, you know, kind of, what do you think about this one? Said the president knew about it, and then tells the Washington Post, well, you know, why would he remember it? I'm sure he forgot about this $130,000 payoff to a porn star with whom he had an affair with and with whom they were trying to silence 11 days before an election.
Right, because what did he say? He
revealed that he'd given cheated on his wife just days after the birth of his son.
Yeah, he'd given $100 million to the campaign. What's $135,000? What's $130,000? The guy was into the campaign for $100 million. He doesn't have time to think about any $135,000. Well, I got to say, based on everything that we know, Trump is keenly conscious of these sorts of payments because he welshes on, he's spent his life welshing on them. You know, he's got some contractor doing, lawn work or yard work at Mar-a-Lago, and he just, you know, he pays him 40 cents on the dollar and says, go ahead, sue me. Like, he's very much conscious of nickel and of the nickel and dime payment structure, as far as we know. So that line from Rudy doesn't really, you know, make much sense. The
continue your thought, because there is a way it makes sense, which is that this was improvisatory, that this was not Rudy's, part of the strategy.
No, you're talking about Rudy's thing. I'm saying Rudy's saying Trump didn't. Okay. But the second thing, I believe, and we'll get into the larger question here, but so I said the moral and then the legal, and then there's the political, right? So the political is, my God, the president had an affair with a porn star. Is that okay with you? I mean, and, you know, and now, you know, his lawyer is taking the fifth, and what lawyer of a president has ever taken the fifth before? And this is so horrible, and what are we going to do? And it's, okay, so that's the political. And the problem is that it appears that when it comes to these stories now, if you don't like Trump, you just add everything to the bill of particulars that you don't like Trump for. And every 2 days or 3 days, there's a new little thing you can put on that endless list of what you don't like Trump for. And then the other side is the people who like Trump are like, all right, so I'm not happy at affair with a porn star, but, you know, but Gorsuch, but the tax cuts, but Hillary could have been president, lock her up, and all of that, right? So that's the political side. And so we have these three sides, and everything comes together to say, where this benefits the where what Rudy did last night potentially benefits the president in the long run is that the sooner he can say, look, everybody knows I had an affair with a porn star, I paid her off. Come at me. What are you going to do about it?
But what has prevented him from saying that so far?
Because he's improvisatory, and he said no, and now he's got the threat of Michael Cohen flipping on him for whatever reason, for whatever it is that he might flip on or might not flip on.
Wait, but I say Trump will still never say I had an affair with a porn star. He'll say I paid her extortion.
Well, that's what he said last night. So he said basically, I paid her off.
About. I mean, all reports we've seen is if the country's not paying very much attention to this story, Melania is.
I think the country's paying plenty of attention to this story.
I don't think so. I don't think this has done anything to him other than.
That doesn't mean they're not paying attention.
Oh, yeah, right.
That doesn't mean they're not paying attention.
It's tiddling.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's where the joke about how this is season two, you know, it's like every season, you got to up the stakes every season.
Yeah, so, I guess so. But like you see, you know, MSNBC hammering this narrative home and wondering why the story that the president had an affair with a porn star isn't hurting his affair or his job approval ratings.
See, I think the president having an affair with a porn star and paying her off and doing all this would be hurting his ratings if there weren't a counter, there weren't a series of counter stories going on that might be dwarfing this with public opinion, most especially North Korea. Like if there's a gigantic thing going on potentially with North Korea and the public knows that it's happening and 62% of the public seems to be supportive of whatever it is that we're doing.
And the American hostages were released.
Right. That hasn't been confirmed yet though, has it?
Well, I don't know, Rudy said it last night. Apparently they've been moved. The story was they've been moved to Pyongyang from whatever prison they were in.
Right.
I assume to somehow fatten them up and, you know, make them presentable, since God knows what condition they're in, since we know what happened to Otto Warmbier.
Yes, they are holding hostages explicitly for this purpose. They are about to be released, and it will be celebrated as a victory when this was entirely the whole point of capturing your hostages, so you can present a false victory, and then Donald Trump will take a lap, which he's already been doing.
Right, but my point is that so if this were, we were discussing what happened when Comey was fired last May and why it was so injurious to Trump. And, you know, support melted down. People were screaming, yelling. It was really terrible. And I think part of that was that he had also just lost the Obamacare repeal and replace fight in the House. And, you know, the Muslim ban was in terrible shape. And everybody in the White House was yelling at everybody else in the White House. And it all looked like, you know, we were in some hilarious, bleak chaos in which nothing was getting done. And then this was on top of it. And now it's a year later and, you know, there's the tax cut and there's, you know, movement on regulatory stuff. And now there are these two big foreign policy things going on with North Korea and Iran. And all of this together suggests that the presidency is functioning in some fashion. And so the impact of Stormy Daniels, which has been going on for a long time now. How long has it been going on? 2 months? 3 months? I mean, it's been going on for a long time.
The Stormy Daniels issue?
When did she resurface? Time. I mean, so basically it's also become just part of the background noise. And just because she's got this, you know, hot dog lawyer who, you know, every 4 or 5 days and he comes up with some pseudo event to keep her in the news, you know, now suing for defamation for Trump saying that he doesn't believe that the guy walked up to her in the parking lot and said, you know, and threatened her.
Yeah,
which,
I mean,
by the way,
you're postulating that the Donald Trump's approval ratings are rising in spite of Stormy Daniels being in the news. I'm suggesting that it might not necessarily be despite, but as a result. Quite a lot of the country isn't necessarily hostile to the idea that having an affair with a pornographic actress is necessarily a bad thing. I know that's kind of crude, but that is the truth.
I think it's as it applies to him, as it applies to Trump. I don't think generally. I think when it comes to him, that's the least of it.
It helps his image.
But by the way, you know, also if to the extent that anyone, any of his critics and enemies are dwelling on his lying, or on the zigzagging, saying I let Comey go for this reason. No, I let him go for that reason. No, I let him go for this reason. After all, or I didn't know about the payment, or I didn't know about those things. I think have absolutely no effect on him, and yet those are the things that his critics cannot let go of.
Well, there's a lot of weirdness. So the weirdness, Rudy said a lot of weird things anyway. He said this bizarre thing about Jared Kushner. He said Trump will not allow Mueller to get anywhere near Ivanka. But while Jared is, quote, a fine man, quote, men are disposable, he said. But a fine woman like Ivanka, come on. So what the hell is that about?
Yeah, going back to the idea that this interview was not the result of very careful planning on the part of anybody in the West Wing, and most certainly
Rudy
Giuliani.
You're having an argument now that we haven't actually surfaced yet. So we should get to the argument part that we planned for, but we haven't started. So I'm going to postulate something, and then Noah is going to argue with it.
Here goes, gang.
Okay, ready? Okay. My argument is that Rudy Giuliani came on last week in the wake of Trump going on Fox and Friends and saying and then tweeting, look, I've been keeping my hands off the Justice Department, but I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to do that, right? So he said that on Fox and Friends, and then he tweeted it. And then Rudy came on and everybody else left. So yesterday, Ty Cobb, his mustachioed lawyer, announced that he was retiring, which is a weird term for a job he's only had for 7 months. He's retiring. His back hurts, and he's been living in an attic, which has weird and frank resonances. I don't think people should, complain that they're living in an attic. I don't even know what he's talking about, and that he's leaving, right? So he's done. So Rudy comes on and the lawyers left. And we just learned from the Daily Beast that, according to Sam Stein and Betsy Woodruff, Trump and Don McGahn, his White House lawyer, are not on speaking terms, which is a weird thing to say. How are you not on speaking terms with your boss if you're Don McGahn? I mean, Trump might not be on speaking terms with McGahn. McGahn is not in a position not to be on speaking terms with his supervisor. But anyway, so they're not on speaking terms. So Rudy is the new lawyer, and when you have a new lawyer, the whole point of the previous efforts, the previous law efforts, once Mark Kasowitz, his first lawyer, was cashiered, was he was bringing on a team that was going to work quietly with Mueller, was going to try to do what it can to have a decent relationship with Mueller's office. So John Dowd and Ty Cobb, and they would have these negotiations, and they would provide documents, and Don McGahn, the White House counsel, they would provide documents and levels of documents, and they would help arrange interviews with White House staff, and with Jared Kushner and with various other people, and they would negotiate with Mueller over a potential interview with the president, right? So they're gone. So you have to say they're gone because Trump may no longer have been a fan of this strategy. And now there's Rudy. And Rudy came on and said, we're going to be done with this in a couple of weeks. And maybe we'll have an interview, but it's going to be very short. And these questions are crazy. This list of questions that got leaked is crazy. There's too many of them. Rudy also goes on to say on Hannity last night that the FBI raiding Michael Cohen's office did so like stormtroopers, which is a staggering thing for the law and order mayor to say about FBI agents, of whom Michael Cohen himself said they were respectful and they were polite, and I have no problem with the way they conducted themselves in my office. But Rudy calls them stormtroopers. Okay, so I think we're seeing here Rudy's hiring as a new stage or a reversal of field for Trump in relation to Mueller. And Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, who is now, because of Jeff Sessions' recusal, is now the point person for all of this. And what I think is that they have decided to go to war, real war, with Mueller and Rosenstein and the Justice Department. And where that war goes, I think, obviously, is the potential end game of this war is the firing of Mueller and Rosenstein. And that what we saw last night, whether Rudy was being reckless or, you know, crazy or improvisatory or not, was the opening gambits in the strategy. What's more, I think you could even say that the real opening gambit was the leaking of the Mueller questions to the New York Times, which apparently was not done by Mueller's office, the purpose of which would be to create outrage among Trump's Republican and conservative supporters on the grounds that Mueller was on a colossal fishing expedition that is totally out of control. And people like, you know, my dear friend Rich Lowry said this yesterday in Politico, that Rod Rosenstein supervising Mueller is allowing Mueller to pursue all of these, you know, he should be controlling him, and Rosenstein is a terrible deputy attorney general, and if Trump fired him, he would have reason to do so. So I think you're seeing the laying out of a potential strategy to fire Mueller and Rosenstein. And I would put it this way, and then Noah can start the argument and Abe can adjudicate, be the referee or the adjudicator. Rudy is a very aggressive, as a politician, Rudy was very aggressive, and his aggression worked as follows. He was in a hostile atmosphere, a conservative mayor in liberal New York with the press against him and all of conventional opinion problematic and, you know, the whole political structure sort of like opposed to him. So what did he do? He went to war. He took every fight to his enemies. They said this, he doubled back. Somebody said, oh, a cop, you know, abused somebody, and he's like, I'm going to give that cop I'm going to have a rally in support of the cops. You know, somebody says there should be more homeless shelters in the city council, and he puts a homeless shelter in that guy's district just to screw with him. That was Rudy as a politician until 9/11, when he obviously had this kind of, you know, elevated transformation. So Trump knows this. Trump knows Rudy. Trump was living in New York at the time. And I think Rudy goes to Trump and says, it's time for you to go to war. It's been a year. They're going after you. They want to kill you. Your lawyers are being all accommodationist. And what good is it doing you? It's not doing you any good. Mueller is settling in for the long run. He's going to do whatever he can to take you down, along with the deep state and the Democrats and everything like that. And the thing to do now is rip off the Band-Aid. Fire him, fire Rosenstein, do it now. It's May, the midterm elections are until November. Is it risky? Sure, it's risky. But, you know, all you are is a risk taker. And fortune favors the bold and fortune favors the brave. You didn't do it. You didn't collude with Russia. The whole thing is nonsense. You didn't obstruct justice. He's going to do whatever he can to trap you with some nonsense charge. So rip off the Band-Aid. Fire them both. There'll be a huge dust storm, and it'll look very bad for a couple of weeks, and then everything will settle back into equilibrium by midsummer in September, and then, you know, and then you can move on with other things. That's my argument for why Rudy's on, and what the Hannity interview, what the possible esoteric meaning of the Hannity interview was. Noah?
Well, I don't know if I disagree with any of that. I just don't think it's indicative of future performance, as it were. This isn't the first time.
By the way, I don't know if I agree with it. I'm just throwing it as a theory.
It's a good theory. this isn't the first time that Rudy Giuliani has come out on television and said something inflammatory, speaking for the president, only to have him look pretty ridiculous in retrospect. Rudy Giuliani came early in the Trump presidency. Rudy Giuliani went on Fox News and started talking for the president about a Muslim ban, quote, Muslim ban, using the term Muslim ban. He was speaking for Donald Trump. He had talked to Donald Trump. Donald Trump talked to him. He was saying what he said Donald Trump had said to him. And I think that the two of them were on the same wavelength. But that wasn't a revelation about policy that was forthcoming. It was just everybody speaking off the cuff. If it was about policy in the Oval Office when they were talking, it didn't manifest in anything because they had since moved back from it because it was a legally problematic approach to the travel ban, and so the cooler heads prevailed. With the conservative intelligentsia, people talking, you know, Donald Trump's dogged defenders and people who have convinced themselves that anything and everything needs to be defended in order to justify judges and what have you, go to the mattresses if they removed Robert Mueller or Rod Rosenstein, for example. Sure, they would. But would that be reflective of what the Republican base thinks? I don't think so. We don't have very much polling that suggests that Rosenstein is unpopular with Republicans. We have polling that suggests Mueller is actually quite popular with Republicans and that they don't want the president to move against this special counsel. And if they did, then the idea that this would lift a pall over the Trump administration is completely bizarre. It would only make it far worse, most notably because, like James Comey, there was a concerted effort to make James Comey a bad guy among Republicans. He was relatively popular, too. And when he was fired, it resulted in a big glut of depressed Republicans who drove down Donald Trump's job approval ratings. And that's what would happen here. I suggest probably 20-25% of the Republican base would get really depressed, and that would be the end of the legislative phase of Trump's presidency and impeachment city, by the way. So that is the argument that has prevailed so far against moving against Robert Mueller's probe. Who knows who's advancing it? Maybe there are people within the West Wing on his shoulder, you know, people who are a little bit more in tune with what the reality is on the Hill than what Donald Trump's, you know, super aggressive posturing would like it to be. Certainly members of Congress would be telling him this. But it is the argument that has prevailed, and I think after the heat of this moment dies down, especially because we don't have really a lot of evidence to suggest it's any more than an improvisation on the part of Rudy Giuliani. It felt really good to say it at the time, but I don't think it was strategy. I think that's the argument that's going to prevail again when everybody lets cooler heads, you know, sort of rise to the top.
Okay, but could it be this, that they are not necessarily, Trump and Giuliani are not necessarily moving towards doing this definitively, but opening a space to reserve the firing of Mueller and Rosenstein as an option should they feel they need it.
I don't think they've ruled that out. I mean, it's
right. But more aggressively making a sort of space for that, because I think there's a difference. Because if this is the plan, we're going to see it happen sooner rather than later. If it's not, I think we're going to see sort of more kicked up controversies about an out-of-control probe.
I should clarify, it might be the plan, but it's also a really stupid plan that I would imagine that everybody who games this out more than two or three steps would acknowledge is a really stupid plan. Well,
What do they say in Animal House? You know, there needs to be a stupid feudal gesture right. on somebody's part, and we're the guys to do it, right? Don't well, party. So here would be my... Here would be my. I don't think that Rudy is... a sound political head at the moment, or has been for a long time, certainly since he, you know, this famously semi-liberal Republican, you know, threw in his lot with Trump, whom he knows to be a fool, or, you know, stuff that I've heard people say, you know, that nobody in New York in the 90s thought well of Trump. I don't care who, you know, Rudy certainly not. So he threw in his cards with him, and there he is. But
only after Jeb got out, by the way, and it was a very lukewarm endorsement.
Yeah, and then they got closer and closer and closer and closer. But, you know, so in the Trump era, a hyper-aggressive Rudy looks at Trump and says, these guys are not serving you well, because this is not, you can't deal with these people. You can't reason with these people, and you can't deal with these people. So you got to be much more aggressive in relation to Mueller and all of this than you have been thus far. Now, what does that mean? I mean, I think it means that he holds the sword of Damocles over Rosenstein's head and Mueller's head. Rosenstein earlier this week said of the Republicans who were calling for his, you know, impeachment or something, he said, the Justice Department will not be extorted. It was a weird word, and I think he misused word, but what he really meant was, I'm not going to be blackmailed into, you know, into doing something I don't think is right, and basically daring Trump to fire him. Now, the truth about Rosenstein, where he stands, is that his firing, like Comey's firing, one of the ways in which it would be an astoundingly stupid move for Trump to fire the guy is, so he fires the guy, then he's got another antagonist outside the administration whose reputation can only be burnished and enhanced by turning state's evidence against Trump in the court of public opinion.
We should add that this theory that Rosenstein can dismiss the special counsel probe means that that authority would devolve to former Solicitor General and now the third in charge over the DOJ, Noel Francisco.
Well, I think he's still the Solicitor General.
Oh, I thought he took over for Brandt.
No, I think he's the Solicitor General and he's acting or something, but he actually made an argument in the Supreme Court on Monday. Neil Francisco. So that's a whole other obstacle.
Right. I mean, we don't necessarily know how he would perform in that.
Okay. Situation. In the rip the Band-Aid theory that I've laid out, that is the temptation of Trump. Let's call it this. Okay. Trump clearly feels aggrieved and beset. And I think to some extent, probably with some justice that, you know, he didn't collude with Russia and this is all a witch hunt. That stuff is real. I don't think he did collude. I don't think he did collude with Russia. I think this is a liberal fantasy. And whether or not he obstructed justice is a secondary issue, though it's a primary issue for his future, but it's a secondary issue in the question of whether or not he colluded with Russia. And he thinks that he's being pursued by a lunatic Inspector Javert and it's not fair, right? So he is standing there, and the temptation of Trump is no one's going to deliver him from this guy. No one can deliver him. No one can stop him. That's the whole nature of independent counsels. And so this independent counsel was appointed sort of against his wishes by his deputies, and he's going to put a stop to it. So then there's this, I believe, lunatic idea that the president, who is the superior official in the executive branch, is not permitted by law to dismiss Mueller, but that Rod Rosenstein, who works at Trump's sufferance and can be fired at any time, he can fire Mueller, but Trump can't. So you could have this situation like the Saturday Night Massacre in 1973 that Nixon did, where Nixon asks his attorney general to fire independent counsel Leon Jaworski, and his attorney general refuses, and then he fires him, and then he fires out, and then it gets down to the level of the person, Robert Bork, who is willing to do the job. Or Trump can say, screw it, I hereby fire Robert Mueller. Okay, now what is the advantage to this? So again, aside from all the political fallout and the disaster and the craziness, so if Mueller says, I'm not going because you don't have the legal authority to fire me, then we have a sort of constitutional crisis on our hands of some sort. And then there's a whole smoke about that. And then there's smoke about Rosenstein. Then there's this. And then there's that. And there's the other thing. And Trump's argument, which he loves so much, that basically he is being pursued by a wolf pack of the deep state, becomes, you know, has flesh on it for a lot of the people who believe this. And there will be a whole cheering section, rooting section. Kim Strassel, the journal editorial page, you know, the various other people, the blogosphere. Is there still a blogosphere? I guess there's kind of a blogosphere. Fox, you know, InfoWars. I don't know, whoever those people are. And he will then be comforted by that. And then the other thing is it just makes everything so confusing. These stories are so hard to follow.
Yeah, but that's the other side of the coin that is terrible for Trump. There is one institution that can deliver exculpation for him when it comes to questions regarding the campaign in Russia, and it is the special counsel. No one else can do that, and if that's dissolved, those are unanswerable questions forever. They will hang over this administration forever. And on top of the fact that we are going into impeachment city, population one, it will absolutely result in the depression of enough of the Republican base, not all of them, maybe 20%, enough of them to stay home, the enthusiasm of the liberal base, deliver the House to the Democrats, and the Senate, by the way, is not super safe. And that will yield impeachment proceedings. So not only will Donald Trump never be free of the idea that the Russia probe, that he colluded with Russia, but he will be facing impeachment for pursuing the second Night of the Long Knives with regard to the Justice Department will make everything worse. And I think that argument is easy enough to make to the point where it has convinced him before. I can't imagine why it wouldn't convince him now.
Okay, here's why it wouldn't convince him now necessarily, which is if he can be convinced or is convinced or becomes convinced that Mueller will not rest, he will never exculpate him. He will look for any comma in a tweet that can be pointed at to say, we have some evidence that the president may have committed obstruction of justice, thus giving material. Mueller's not going to indict Trump. That's not the way it works. He will give material to the House for potential impeachment proceedings. So if he believes that Mueller will not exculpate him, then he doesn't need Mueller there. Now, here's the interesting, now to get really in the weeds. So just to make sure everybody understands, the House votes to impeach. The Senate then has a trial that will either convict the president or acquit him. And this is what happened with Clinton. Clinton was impeached by the House, cleared by the Senate.
Very narrowly, as I recall.
No. Clinton?
I thought it was narrow.
No, it was a walk. 20 votes. Not even a majority.
I'm thinking of Andrew Johnson.
Yeah. Andrew Johnson was 2 votes. But no, Clinton walked very comfortably, and so would Trump. I mean, you're talking about even if the Democrats win the Senate somehow magically, they have to get 67 senators. They would probably win with 51 Senate, which is very unlikely, but it could happen, and they would still not get 16 Republicans to convict him. So, but here's the interesting getting in the weeds part. So presumably fires Mueller, and the grounds on which the articles of impeachment will be written is that he obstructed justice by firing Mueller. There is a long body of opinion on these matters that says there is no way on earth that you can convict a president for exercising his constitutional authority as head of the executive branch. You cannot do it. Mueller and Rosenstein are subsidiary officials of the executive branch. They serve at the whim of the president, though they Rosenstein's case, he had to be confirmed by the Senate, but that doesn't protect him from firing. And the idea that you can then say that his firing was an act that required him that deserves a conviction for obstruction of justice is highly problematic. Now, that doesn't mean Trump should go for a strategy of impeachment that will then lead to his acquittal, right? However, there is a body of bonkers right-wing opinion, you have to say, where people are saying, sure, let him get impeached. This is just going to prove everything that he's saying, that the Democrats are crazy and they've impeached him and it's crazy. And when he's convinced, look at what happened to Clinton. Clinton left office at 65% approval after impeachment because, he was fired out without result. If you're going to, if you're going to aim at the king, you have to kill the king. They won't be able to kill Trump and it'll be good for him. It'll be a big spectacle and he'll be able to make his case and blah, blah, blah. Now, that's Meshuggah. But there are people who are arguing this.
Well, also just to add to it, isn't there what about the idea that he's going to face impeachment anyway? If the GOP is going to lose in midterms, it's going to be impeachment city, party of one, in any case.
72% of Democrats in the last poll favor impeachment proceedings against the president.
Okay, so that's the only way to prevent that is to prevent the Democratic takeover of the House. And how do you do that?
But maybe maybe you're Trump or you're Paul Ryan or whatever, you're not going to be able to block it.
Your suggestion was that the appointment of Emmett Flood, to a former Clinton impeachment attorney, to join the legal team suggests that they've already priced this in, that the House is gone,
right.
That the Mueller probe is going to be dissolved or it's going to come back with a recommendation against the president and they're going to move forward with impeachment and they're on to phase two.
Well, they are preparing for the potential of phase two.
So I don't think that's necessarily true because it just strikes me as too fatalist. If they believe their own hype, and I think they do, then they think the game is still very much in play.
That's an interesting question. So the evidence that the House is still in play is Trump's approval rating is up. to around 42%, which is still not, you know, which is still bad.
But better than it's been in a year.
But better than it's been in a year, but it's still bad. And the generic number, that is the polling number that's when you ask who do you want, a Democrat or Republican, to, you know, vote for in November, the generic number is around 6 or 7. And there was a poll yesterday that had it at 3. Okay, but 6 or 7 with the president at 42 still wins the Democrats the House under almost anybody's reckoning. And that's not even a wave. So in a wave election, there is a national force that tilts any or most seats that are in contention one direction, right? So as it happens, there are something like 54 potential seats in contention. So a wave could be 40 seats or 50. Democrats only need 23, and that's not even a wave victory. Like, Democrats won 26 in 1982 in an election that was not a wave, because the Senate certainly didn't break like a wave. So we don't know what's going to happen there, but you know, you can whistle a happy tune, and indeed it is the case that if for reasons that we don't understand, you know, if the Korea negotiations have a what appears to be a highly positive result, that is going to be extraordinarily good news for Trump, who just 8 months ago, Democrats that I was on and liberals that I was on MSNBC with were like, my children can't sleep. They're so worried that we're going to be in a nuclear war with Korea. So if he denuclearizes, then I don't think this is going to happen. But if he denuclearizes the Korean Peninsula, the man who was going to get us into a nuclear war, I mean, that's going to be very big, right? Am I wrong?
Yeah. I mean, it would be really remarkable if that were to happen. But I can also think of a lot of really remarkable things that have very low percentages of actual success rates.
Okay, so, I mean, another it's just kind thing of for
a,
you.
A hypothetical.
So he pulls out of the Iran deal. Everybody on Twitter, every, you know, echo chamber, you know, baby Stalinist from the echo chamber and the Obama administration who want to accuse people like friends of ours like Seth Mandel of being anti-Semites for opposing the Iran deal, you know, with their, you know, idiotic Pod Save America nonsense, that they're all screaming and yelling about how the deal is so important and all of this. Remember, the deal is very unpopular. I mean, I don't know if it's been polled into it, but, you know, it was 62% of the public opposed the Iran deal. So unless somehow the Iran deal suddenly, just because it's old, has reversed polarities, Trump pulling out of the Iran deal, liberals and Democrats are sort of forgetting that people didn't like it. So it's like the mandate. It's like the
I was about to say, but Obamacare sort of, you know, got more popular as Trump was, you know, was moving to kill it, right?
Right, except for the one thing that got removed, right? The mandate, which was removed in the tax cut bill, 70% of people opposed it. That's the one thing that they managed to nail.
All this is happening as the Trump administration has sort of managed to escape the gravitational pull of the investigation into his campaign. It's sort of slunk into the background. Again, we're talking about Stormy Daniels more than we were Russia over the course of the last several months, which has nothing to do with the Russia probe and very little to do with anything that isn't priced into Donald Trump, the man. His indiscretions and his character flaws are not news. They're baked in. Everybody knows about them. The Russia probe has sapped a little bit of the credibility of this administration, and to reignite it, to give it the centerpiece of, you know, the center of attention, would swamp the North Korea news, would swamp the Iran deal news. It would demonstrate that the press has something that they're actually moving on, you know, that tracks them, and they have a reason to go so hard at it instead of just being myopically focused on it, as they have been with the Stormy Daniels thing.
To John's point, doesn't that sound exactly like something Trump would do?
What?
Reignite this problematic story and step on whatever potential
yeah, but for the life of me, I can't imagine why. I mean, there are definitely people around him who are telling him, don't do this. And that argument has prevailed. I can't see why it wouldn't prevail today, just because Rudy Giuliani, is a combative person.
Well, the reason it wouldn't is that he agrees with Rudy that he should go to war, and the people that have been telling him not to do this, he's fired, and he's not talking to his White House counsel.
We don't know. We don't know that. We don't know if all the people who have told him that.
I didn't say all the people, but the legal team that told him not to lose it has been replaced. Dowd and Cobb are gone. That was the team that said, "Let us work our magic, and you try to keep it together." And Rudy said, "Get rid of those guys," and he got rid of those guys. That's the way I look at it now. So you can look at it and say there must be angels sitting on his shoulder.
No, I think there are definitely people in the West Wing that are saying otherwise. I'm not sure who they are, but I could guess. But I definitely think that's coming from the Hill.
Yeah, but they don't listen to the Hill. We know they don't listen to the Hill.
They have listened to the Hill often when it comes to just about every legislative strategy.
Well, this is not a legislative strategy, and they don't even have a what legislative strategy they have now. What are they trying to pass? That's the interesting thing. You said this is the end of their legislative agenda. The only thing they want is like confirmations of judges, which is not exactly a legislative strategy. Anyway, the whole point here is that we have entered into a new, there's something new going on, and it's important to note that something new is going on. And finally, you know, why it is necessary to... We are a week away from the U.S. Embassy moving to Jerusalem, we're weeks away from the summit. And I mean, that to me is the other interesting aspect of this, is the utter inability of the president and his people, the sort of ADD-ness of them, that they cannot, there's nothing better for him than for him to look like he was spending 6 hours a day on Korea. Nothing. He's having meetings with Pompeo. They're discussing where it's going to go. They're having this. They're doing that. They're having this measure. They're talking to this guy. All that. All of that would do nothing but burnish him. And he doesn't feel that way. See, he thinks that if he's not fighting, if he's not in a broigus, as my grandmother would say, he's losing. And that he's got to take the fight. And as I said, that's Rudy's temptation to him. That's Rudy's strategy. And, you know, he and Rudy are the same age. They come out of the same borough, I think. I think Rudy's from Queens. They moved to Brooklyn. From the same borough. They're not the same ethnic group, and they're not the same socioeconomic category. But, you know, they have this, the commies are going to kill you, so kill them first. And remember, they got a lot of support for that among their, you know, among the people that make them happy and comfortable. So, what else should we talk? Anything else we should talk about?
Well, we don't have a ton of time left in the podcast, but you did touch on the Iran deal stuff and the reaction to it. Or rather, the reaction to Benjamin Netanyahu's speech.
Right.
Which is sort of tangentially related to the Iran deal. But
right, so we spent the...
More or less related to world peace.
So we spent the whole podcast last time pretty much talking about Netanyahu's speech. And
but not the reaction to it.
Right.
which is where all the meat is. Right.
So there are two interesting things, one of which is the speech is a nothing burger, says everybody on the left, on the grounds that either it's a nothing burger or it affirms the need for the deal. Right? Because...
Simultaneously.
Right.
Right.
Okay. But here's the part of it that's so astonishing to me, is that in the effort to sort of focus on this question of the deal, not the deal, and what was revealed by the revelation of Project Ahmad, what the Israelis captured in this giant, you know, intelligence operation will tell us so much about Iranian possibilities and capabilities and what they were aiming for, and will tell the Israelis all of this, and will probably, as you said, I think the last podcast, will probably tell us something about the North Korean program, because they were sort of in cahoots and probably trading information and data and details. So at the very least, poo-pooing this astounding operation. And I think it's arguable. It's arguable you can say that information dating back to 2003 that shows that they had an active program that they slowed down and repurposed into a different set of programs with the same leadership, that it does not represent a smoking gun or the knockout punch that says the Iran deal should go away. There is some case to be made on the other side that yes, we knew that they were trouble, and we made a deal that tried to the purpose of which was to handcuff them and to prevent them from moving further for at least a decade.
I think as Abe did a lot of research, which suggests that quite a lot of the pretense on which the Iran deal was sold was predicated on the assumption that they would also be coming clean. And the notion that there is nothing new here is betrayed by the fact that anybody who's actually dug into the documents has found quite a bit of new information to Western observers. There is a lot of pride tied up in the notion that this is all nothing. It was all revealed in the 2007 National Security Estimate and 2011 IAEA report. But Abe went back and did a lot of the research on the transcripts and found out that we were supposed to know about all this stuff, allegedly, right?
Absolutely. According to John Kerry, there would be no deal without our knowing exactly what Iran had by their own admission. They had to come clean if there was going to be a deal. You know, part of what keeps this whole argument alive is the fact that every aspect of the Iran deal was shrouded in so much mystery. It's very hard to say what the letter of the deal stipulates on these points, because there are like three different components to it. There are these sort of side agreements and follow-on agreements, and no one is entirely sure what's in all of them, and the whole process was fluid. So before there was the actual deal, John Kerry said on multiple occasions, in order for there to be an agreement, Iran must come clean and tell us what their nuclear program consists of, what they've been up to.
Then
there was a deal, and then he said it's not important to know what they were up to. We have a deal. There was never any, we are going to take that out of the deal. It's not, or even saying it's not in the deal. It no longer matters. That there was a pre-deal and a post-deal, and we don't yet. What's the deal?
Not only that, the duplicity that was relevant here or shown here by putting all this information in a civilian warehouse known only to a handful of ranking officials in Tehran. That is evidence that we need this deal even more than we needed it the day before.
Right.
Well, I believe, and I think the central point is it Fordo? I mean, they're the
Fordo and Parchin.
Fordo and Parchin were the two enrichment facilities, and we know two things about the enrichment facilities. One of which is at least one of them is the IAEA has not been allowed into.
No, I don't think either. I'm not sure about Fordo, but so definitely they Parchin. Parchin they have to observe from space.
So they were supposed to take offline 2/3 of the centrifuges that enrich uranium. And the Iranian deputy foreign minister said last week that they have better centrifuges now. Right. So they removed some and they built some new ones. So now they have ones that can enrich uranium to weapons grade level much faster than they could before. And so how that's not, I don't understand how that doesn't constitute a violation of the deal if the deal was they were supposed to take centrifuges offline.
Right. And there's also an open question about whether or not everything the Israelis discovered about their preserving the knowledge and records of this nuclear program after they were supposed to have shut it down, if that in itself constitutes a violation of the deal, because what is that being preserved for by the state? If you're holding on to the blueprints of a nuclear weapons program, what is that?
Right. Well, it's just the timeline, right? So the whole point was that the timeline lengthened. So before the deal, there was a question about whether or not Iran was 6 months to a year away from a bomb, meaning if they decided to go nuclear, how long would it take them to enrich uranium to a weapons-grade level, put it on a warhead, and have it ready for firing, right? So the idea was they didn't know it was like 6 months to a year because they had all this uranium that was at 20% weapons grade level. And once you get to 20, getting it up to 80 is pretty fast. So that was the question. So this theoretically was supposed to stretch the timeline from 6 months to a year to about 11 years, right? So they would agree to this deal. They would have all their money, their frozen assets unlocked. They could do stuff with that. And in exchange, they would sort of stop doing any work. And when they could come back online legally with a program that they could do whatever they wanted to, then the question would be how long would it take them to get to a bomb? and maybe they would come to their senses. And then, of course, there was all that nonsense about how there was a fatwa now against nuclear weapons. That was, remember, yeah. Kerry and Obama. Yes. Obama told Jeff Goldberg that since there was now a fatwa against the use of nuclear weapons, that we could trust that there would be no nuclear weapons.
I can't hear that word now without singing the song from the musical.
Yeah.
Fatwa.
Fatwa from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Right. That's right. Fatwa the Musical by Larry David.
We've heard is also the inspections regime that was in the Iran deal is so vital.
It's the most intrusive that we've ever seen.
Inspection regime.
Intrusive.
The inspections regime is nonsense. The IAEA has said the inspections regime is very problematic because they have seen these, like we said, they have to observe these institutions from satellite positions, and they've seen developments at places like Parchin that were frustrating. In September of last year, the U.S. floated the possibility of U.N. observers going to these military sites, which was greeted with great trepidation from Iranian officials and haughty blowback, saying the Americans will take their dream of visiting our military and sensitive sites to their graves. It will never happen. A top leader for Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei told reporters at the time, the inspections regime is a joke, and the evidence that the Iran deal is being maintained and adhered to is betrayed by the very existence of these documents. Also, the revelation of this intelligence operation is, as I wrote in a blog post yesterday, really pretty scary. I mean, there's a lot of collection capability there that Israel blew up. And they've been engaging in quite a few acts of direct military confrontation with Iranian assets in Syria. And this stuff is getting really, really quite dangerous. So the issue isn't really protecting Barack Obama's legacy, which seems to be the chief priority of members of the former administration. It is about observing as temperatures are really rising to a boiling point and what we're going to do to drive them back down.
Well, that's a real issue. And again, I think when we come down to it, Reagan famously said, "Doverai no proverai, trust but verify," right? So the whole point that we keep being told by the supporters of the Iran deal is that it's precisely that our distrust, the fact that we can't trust the Iranians, that makes the deal so important. So there's verify without trust. And according to Noah's and Abe's, sort of understanding of this, we can't even verify. So we have no trust. And we can't verify.
And the biggest.
This is a great basis for a deal. The notion is that it's sacrosanct and untouchable.
Right. But, and the straw man you will hear is that, obviously the only alternative to the Iran deal is to go toe-to-toe in
war.
Desert. Right. And yeah. Spectacular bloodshed.
Yeah. And they say again, yes, van driver Tommy Vidor. Whose entire
we have cooked up yeah. cooked he alleged yeah. that we cooked up intelligence. Yeah, I don't think that's what he really meant.
We cooked
up
intelligence and went to war. That's right. All we want is war. That's all we want.
Cooked up intelligence that was already known.
Well known cooked up intelligence that comes that every single thing that Netanyahu showed in the speech is from an Iranian document. Yeah. It's from Iranian documents that, the Israelis were good enough to manage to seize. Whereas America's human intelligence has no such power or authority
in fact,
to do
Iran
so.
Iran essentially sees that from the IAEA. These were their documents, according to the head of the NIAC Council.
That's right.
No,
Israel sees them. Israel hacked. IAEA. Yeah.
That's right. So here are these alleged. It's cooked up intelligence that was hacked from the IAEA. Which I believe, and David Albright, who at the International Institute for Strategic Studies is the leading expert on nuclear proliferation and all of this stuff, says that this is a gold mine of the sort that no one has ever seen before. I mean, except when Libya basically opened itself up to us and showed us everything that they had. So anyway, it's just a comic situation. I think you can make the case. I do think, I got to say, I think it's a terrible deal, but I think there is a case to be made that upsetting the status quo at this without a clear delineated plan of what happens after you abrogate the deal is problematic. And that why would you seek to do that in the absence of any evidence that nuclearization is going on? But that is not the argument that's made. The argument's made is to test and challenge the bona fides of the people who think that the deal is problematic and that the Israeli information gives you some real justification for ending it. And so their disingenuousness, it's an interesting thing. It's like projection. They're disingenuous, and then they project disingenuousness on people like the Prime Minister of Israel, whose country's life is at stake if Iran...
Oh, that was a great argument that I read yesterday in Defense One, which was saying that not only there are some new things in here, like news about metallurgy work and yield amounts and test sites that were being prepared. People who are supposed experts in this field saying there's nothing new here have not read the documents or have not read sound analysis on them. But the claim was that this is a pretty modest attempt at a nuclear deterrent. It was like South Africa's nuclear deterrent. It was like supposed to be designed strictly for show and never to be used really, and yeah, only in the event of a catastrophic event. And Israel is not Zimbabwe. It cannot absorb a nuclear strike. It would be a second Holocaust.
You know, the problem with the public discussion is that like the peace talks in Israel, there is now an industry that sprung up around the deal. There is a network of people whose job it is to support the deal in perpetuity. This is and they're the ones that are tearing down any opposition to the deal.
Right.
It's not a policy argument anymore. It's an entirely removed phenomenon from what's happening. It's about the perpetuation of a certain sub industry in foreign policy.
Right. So. That brings us to a close of this week's podcast. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.